we're pleased to have Abhay Ashtakar. He did his PhD at the University of Chicago, postdoc at Oxford, and then faculty positions at Paris and Syracuse before moving to Penn State, where he is currently the director for the Institute of Gravitation and the Cosmos. He's won more honors and awards than I would have time to mention, among them that most coveted of positions, Perimeter Institute DVRC. And today he's going to tell us about loop quantum cosmology.
Thank you. Is that a point difference?
There's a hockey stick. There may be a laser pointer somewhere as well.
So basically, over the last 10 years or so, loop quantum gravity in the cosmological sector has become sufficiently mature that one can do very detailed calculations and compare with observations. And what I want to tell you about is kind of interesting interplay between theory and observations. Basically, observations are now beginning to inform theory, and the theory from the theoretical side, there are also new predictions. This is a work by really a lot of people. I mean, there are, I think, between 15 and 20,000 papers in loop quantum cosmology. But in this talk, I'm just going to focus mainly by contributions that have come from these various people, and the names that appear in red, I'm using their work very directly. And I just want to say that this is since it's a colloquium, I'm going to give you a global summary without entering into details and particularly finer points, which are interesting and important, but unfortunately there's not enough time. And there are also many generalizations which are occurred, and I'm not going to be able to do this. On the other hand, you know, you can ask me questions, and I'm also going to be here until Friday, so please, you know, feel free to ask me more details if you're interested. Okay, so let me sort of start with the setting the stage, basically. So observational and theoretical advances in cosmology have been spectacular, as we all know, over the last two decades. And basically, starting from just one part in 100,000 inhomogeneities in the cosmic microwave background, known physics, you know, basically general relativity, perturbation theory, hydrodynamics, gastrodynamics, elementary quantum processes, that really predicts that the inhomogeneities will grow and lead to the observed large-scale structure of the universe that we see today. Now, a lot of young people here, I'm very happy with that. And you guys are really, really lucky, because this is the first time in the history of the universe, right, history of humankind, that we have sort of come to this stage up here. And it really is a real triumph, because if I just take the ratios and transfer this to the human scale, lifetime of a human being, then this is really like analogous to starting with a snapshot of a baby who is only 1 year old, and then having the detailed physiology, biochemistry, and everything, you know, that's all we understand so well that we can actually put in a computer program and tell you what the profile of the human being would be 100 years from now. I mean, imagine how much biology would have to progress to do that. And that we can do with our universe. The baby is a cosmic microwave background, and the 100-year-old human being is today. Now, but physics is, of course, more ambitious, and what we want to know is the following. If we start with this tiny inhomogeneities, then we can predict the large-scale structure, but what produced these tiny inhomogeneities in the first place at all? And there are many ideas, and among them, the most successful one, or at least the one that is developed in greatest detail, is inflation. And an inflationary scenario that has had really big success, basically, the issue of origins is now really pushed back. Here, cosmic microwave background epoch, the matter density or the curvature is about 10 to the 100 minus 114 in the Planck scales, whereas at the onset of inflation, it is only 10 to the minus 12 in Planck units. So we really have gone some 102 orders of magnitude in this inflationary scenario. So it's really quite a feat. And furthermore, conceptually, it is very appealing because, in a way, all these fluctuations that we talk about in the cosmic microwave background, in these scenarios, they really start, not just inflation, but also other scenarios, They really start with vacuum fluctuations at some epoch, year and onset of inflation. So the large scale structure we see everywhere is really emerged out of vacuum fluctuations. In other words, the universe could, in principle, not be completely homogeneous and isotropic, because Heisenberg comes and says that's not possible because of uncertainty principles, and there will be these vacuum fluctuations, and these fluctuations then grow and form the universe. So I think it's a very beautiful story. But spectacular as this success is, inflationary scenario is really conceptually incomplete, because it assumes that the space-time geometry of general relativity is valid all the way up to the Big Bang, where, of course, the theory breaks down and where God infinity is happening up here. And in fact, even before the Big Bang is reached, when we enter the Planck regime, when the curvatures become of the scale of Planck curvature, density becomes Planck density, which is about 10 to the 92 grams per cubic centimeter. So it's about 80 orders of magnitude higher than that of the neutron stars, for example. But at that time, however, we know that general relativity cannot be trusted. And in fact, if you use quantum field theory in curved space-time, which is what is used in these frameworks, to these epochs, then we have Trans-Planckian problems. So the goal of this talk is to address the question, can we extend this scenario all the way back to the Planck scale? And there's a lot of work in the last 3 years, but the basic ideas were laid out here. And particularly for students, there is a Viewpoint article by Param Singh, which sort of explains this in general terms. So what are the limitations of the inflationary scenarios? There are two kinds of limitations. The one comes from particle physics side. Basically, you know, what is an inflaton? You know, we don't have any thing in the standard model of particle physics. So, I mean, there's not a clear-cut understanding of in the standard model from where the inflaton could come. Is there a single inflaton? Are there many inflatons? What are the interactions between them? And the general idea, the general paradigm, is that the models of the standard particles and fields of the standard model were created during this reheating at the end of inflation. What were the interactions? What happened? And so on. So these are a lot of open questions here that people are still sort of groping with. But there is a second kind of work, a second kind of questions, which has to do with quantum gravity issues. And that is what I'm going to focus here. And these issues in cosmology literature have been sort of discussed over the years quite a lot by Robert Brandenburger and Jerome Martin. Basically, they fall into the following categories. As I already mentioned to you, the Big Bang singularity is present also in the inflationary models. And in the beginning, there was a hope that because we're going to scale a field that violates some energy conditions that are used in the Penrose-Hawking theorem, somehow in inflation, there is no singularity. But that hope is not realized. And in fact, there are nice theorems due to Borodin, Guth, and Wellenkin, which shows that, in fact, even in inflation all the way in the infinite past, then there will be geodesic incompleteness, and you have these singularity theorems. So is this singularity then resolved by quantum gravity, as has been hoped in the 70s? And then what is the nature of the quantum space-time that replaces the Einstein's continuum in the Planck regime? Second kind of questions that we ought to ask is the following. In the inflationary scenario, you have got a slow roll of inflation, and that is sort of critical.
So can I stop you in that? So, I mean, this thing, we know the Big Bang does become singular in ordinary Big Bang, because density goes to infinity at some point. But then this, I mean, the inflation in space-time, you could either have a global Lissajous space-time, or you could just have, I mean, even a Poincaré patch. The density doesn't go to infinity, it's finite. And then these theorems, I guess, I mean, the geodesic incompleteness just tells you that, I mean, the Poincaré patch of Lissajous is not complete.
Poincaré patch is complete, there's no problem. Poincaré patch is not complete. I mean, sorry, say it again. Poincaré patch is incomplete.
It's incomplete. That's what I'm saying. Right. So you just need to look at the global Lissajous, if you will. And I mean, it's just like saying that what is good in inflation is that everything vanishes away. But that means that if you another way of putting it, if you run things back in time, then they blue shift, so they dominate inflation. But that's not how inflation works. Things are quantum mechanical. It's not classical.
Right. Right.
So I'm just wondering, is that really a reason? I can't imagine. Starting from just a class, zero perturbations, in visitor space, right?
Right. You can imagine that. Right? Okay. So I think it's a colloquial level, so I just want to sort of reassure people that there are theorems which go beyond the standard Hawking papers.
But I mean, I guess I don't really think it's at the same status, because... I mean,
it is not at the same status, but the statement is that it's not that we don't know anything. There are theorems which we do know. So then is it... Okay. The second thing is that does the slow roll that is used to account for the CMB, does it come from natural initial conditions at the beginning that replaces the Big Bang and quantum gravity? The next question is, in classical general relativity, if we evolve the modes of interest, the modes that we actually are there of interest, because those are the ones we see in CMB, if we evolve them back in time, they become transplanckian, then therefore, is there a quantum field theory on quantum cosmological spacetimes that is needed to resolve them? So basically, if you go and enter the Planck regime, presumably classical general relativity fails, and therefore there's something else that is there, quantum gravity, quantum geometry, and the question is, can we actually do quantum field theory on this quantum geometry? And then finally, is the pre-inflationary dynamic compatible with the standard assumptions underlying inflation? So for example, it may happen that you have a pre-inflationary dynamics, I mean, you resolve the Big Bang, you have some dynamics there, but then somehow the initial conditions that you get for the perturbations are not at all like what are assumed in inflation, and therefore if you can calculate the power spectrum, you will actually get violations with observation. In other words, it's a non-trivial check that the pre-inflationary dynamics is actually compatible with observations. And secondly, and two other questions. First of all, it should be compatible with the current observations. And then the question is whether, in fact, there are new observational predictions that can be made from this pre-inflationary dynamics, from this quantum gravity epoch, so that we can actually have observational tests of quantum gravity. And finally, conversely, can we learn something about quantum gravity from observations? So the first two questions really refer to the background dynamics. You know, you've got a background, cosmological space-time, and then for the background dynamics. And the last two questions here refer to the perturbations. And this is what we're going to sort of, these are the questions that we want to address up here. And that is the focus of this talk. And the answer that we get from loop quantum gravity, this is a summary, so you know where we're going, basically, and we're going to develop this in some detail, is that, in fact, as far as the background is concerned, the Big Bang singularity is, in fact, naturally resolved and is replaced by a big bounce. So there are no infinities. The matter density doesn't become infinite. Curvature doesn't become infinite. And therefore, the goals that have been laid out by Wheeler, DeWitt, and Misner, they are actually achieved here. And furthermore, this all happens because of certain quantum geometry effects that are characteristic of loop quantum gravity. So in Friedman model, in the classical theory, we're going to scale factor as a function of time, and we're going to scale a field as a function of time. This is now replaced by just a wave function, a quantum state, which now depends on both A and phi. And you see the time variable up here has sort of gone away. Basically, you can use, say, the scalar field as a relational time variable. It's one of the physical fields. So we can think of this as a relational time variable with respect to which the scale factor evolves, or conversely. In loop quantum cosmology, it is usually the scalar field that is used as a time variable, and the scale factor, matter density, in anisotropies, and so on, are the observables then which evolve with respect to this internal time variable. So this is the background. What about the perturbations? So we got sort of two tensor modes and a scalar mode for perturbations. And therefore, now we've got a wave function of perturbations, which depends on these modes up here. And they now, however, propagate not on a classical space-time of Friedman, Robertson, Walker, but they propagate on the background geometry, which itself is quantum mechanical. So we've got a background geometry which is quantum mechanical. And therefore, we're really doing quantum gravity, so the Planck scale issues are faced squarely by using quantum geometry in the Planck regime up here. Then, what about natural initial conditions? Yes, there are really some conditions, as we'll see what they are and what the naturality means. There do exist states such that you can specify certain physical conditions on them, And now the total state is going to be the background state, tensor product into the perturbations. And we can do such that the conditions that we want to impose are that the desired flow role is actually, we put some natural initial conditions up here, and the consequence is that the desired flow role is actually achieved, and the back reaction of the perturbations on the background remains negligible, so that this can be treated as a perturbation propagating on this quantum wave function, which is the background, and all the way from the bounds to the onset of the slow roll. So here we're taking care of the background, here we're taking care of the perturbations propagating on this quantum background, and we have a consistency check that we first treat this as a perturbation, we evolve the whole system, and then back, and we check that in fact the back reaction is negligible. And this one can do over the 11 orders of magnitude that separate the Planck regime from the onset of inflation. And then there is an agreement with the standard inflation for this angular modes, L's, if you like, YLM L's, which are bigger than or equal to 30. But for the longest wavelengths, for the largest angular scale, the pre-inflationary dynamics can leave imprints. And for example, the power spectrum can be suppressed for L less than or equal to 30. Now, this seems counterintuitive at first, because most of the time you would think that if you have quantum gravity effects, they should really affect the ultraviolet regime, not the infrared regime, not the longest wavelength regime. So how does this happen? And I will explain that in some detail. So LQC provides a completion of the inflationary scenario, creating an interesting interplay between observation and quantum gravity. And this is what I would like to explain these points in some detail. So first of all, singularity resolution in loop quantum cosmology. Let us take the simplest model, and this model is just classical trajectory. Here I'm plotting volume. So it could be volume of, for example, this glass, some physical object. And as the universe expands, the physical volume of these physical objects actually increases. So this is the volume up here, or if you like, it's a cube of the scale factor. And here is the scalar field. And we've got two kinds of trajectories, those which start at the Big Bang and expand out to infinity, and those which start out at infinity and then end their life in the Big Crunch. Now, the question that we want to ask is the following. This is classically, what is happening classically. Supposing at late times on the expanding branch, I give a wave function which is sharply peaked on this classical trajectory, and I evolve back in time. Does it also follow the classical trajectory and end its life in a singularity, or do quantum effects actually start dominating? And what we find in LQC is that quantum effects do start dominating. Here is the absolute value of the wave function, and here is the scalar field, and here is a volume. So late times, scalar field up here, large. Say I start up here with a wave function sharply peaked, and I take the trajectory, I take a wave function which is following the classical trajectory. So what happens? Well, until about here, when the energy density becomes a few hundredth of our Planck density, it follows the classical trajectory, but then there's a bounce. So classically, this trajectory would have just gone into zero volume, but now instead, there's a bounce, and you come out on the other side. Now, there's a whole bunch of questions about these bounces and so on that I'll be able to discuss with you in detail, but here, I just want to tell you that that in fact the singularity is resolved and everything is regular. It's the same picture here, which is basically the peak of the wave function. And what is happening is that over here we've got an expanding branch, over here we've got a contracting branch, and here quantum gravity effects become very important, and they create a bridge between the expanding branch and the contracting branch. And therefore, we get a resolution of the singularities. So what is behind the singularity resolution? Well, loop quantum gravity, as many of you know, is based on a specific quantum Riemannian geometry. In the Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker models, the quantum Einstein's equations dictate the relational evolution of this wave function that I just mentioned to you. And now what we, so this is the dynamics that we're looking at, the dynamics of this relational evolution of this. In other words, how does psi change as we change phi up here? Now, the key modification is well captured in the effective equations. We've got Einstein's equations. On the left-hand side, we really have the geometrical part. On the right-hand side, we've got the matter part. What really changes is the geometrical part. But because it's a colloquium, I don't want to give the details of the derivation. And to understand what is happening, right, without really going into details, just through algebraic manipulations, we can shift the modification from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. When we do that, the left-hand side the Friedman equation is a standard one, A dot over A upon squared. This is a standard Friedman equation. And the standard Friedman equation is in red. It is 8 pi g over rho over 3. That is the equation. But now it gets naturally, without any input from quantum geometry effects, gets a correction term, rho upon rho critical, where rho critical is about half the Planck density up here. Now, if I had only the red equation, then energy density is always positive. Therefore, this never vanishes. Therefore, if A dot starts out to be positive, then it remains positive, so you are always in the expanding branch. Or if it is negative, then you are always negative, you are, are always in the contracting branch. But because of this minus sign, which comes naturally in loop quantum gravity, no adjustment or fine-tuning is required here. So you get 1 minus rho over rho critical. So where rho is equal to rho critical, this vanishes, A dot vanishes, and that is where the universe can be contracting and then start expanding. In the contracting branch, A dot is negative. In the expanding branch, it is positive. So the Big Bang is replaced by big bounce. There's a nice separation of scales. The effects become negligible when rho is much less than rho critical. Therefore, there's no problem with general relativity, and because this is really the Planck density. And furthermore, the eigenvalues of the physical observables, such as matter density and curvature, all have an absolute upper bound in the physical Hilbert space of this particular theory, of this sign not up here. And therefore, really, these things cannot even in principle blow up. It's not just on some solutions they don't blow up. They don't blow up anyway. And the mechanism is not that there is a unphysical matter with some negative energy density. All the energy conditions are satisfied up here. But rather, the quantum geometry creates a brand new repulsive force in the Planck regime, overwhelming the classical attraction. So this is what is happening, basically. If you go back in time, the universe is collapsing, right? Because forward in time is expanding, back in time is collapsing. And gravitational attraction is taking over. And in general relativity, this attraction causes the Big Bang, the singularity. Here, when the matter density enters a Planck regime, then there is a new repulsive force that causes this repulsion. This repulsive force of quantum mechanical origin is also what occurs, as I said here, in neutron stars. Because in neutron stars, you have got gravitational attraction. There's no radiation pressure. There are no nuclear reactions. And therefore, you know, gravitational attraction should just completely contract this neutron star. But rather, because of Fermi non-degeneracy pressure, that balances and you have the stable configurations. But for neutron stars, when the mass of the neutron star is bigger than 10 solar masses, then unfortunately, the Fermi non-degeneracy cannot help. Gravity still dominates and attracts. Here, the mechanism is the quantum nature of geometry and not quantum nature of matter, not because of a fermionic nature of anything. It's really a completely new effect. And because of that, no matter how much the total mass is, it can be the whole universe, there is still a bounce that takes place. And this has been understood well in complete detail in the Hamiltonian mathematical framework, mathematical framework, and also in the consistent histories framework. The consistent histories framework was done by Craig, not Carey, but Craig and Smith, sing up here. And there are many generalizations. Here I just looked at Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker, but you can add cosmological constant, you can add anisotropies, Bianchi models, which is very highly non-trivial, because there are many situations, many other models, for example, in string cosmology, that you can take care of the Big Bang in absence of anisotropies. But because anisotropies come with 1 upon scale factor to the sixth term in the Friedman equation, once they are brought in, they cannot avoid Big Bang. But here the statement is that anisotropies have been included in great detail. And the qualitative summary is that every time a curvature scalar starts exploding, it enters a Planck regime, the repulsive force dilutes it. So something is collapsing, it's trying to blow up. In classical general relativity, it would blow up. But here, the repulsive force, the new effect, actually, of quantum geometry, diluted, and therefore, the singularity formation is avoided.
Are there any new, like, classical static critical solutions? I mean, sorry, not classical. Critical static solutions from this repulsive force, where you just contract and stop, and the pressure balances the expansion?
No, we don't have any critical solutions. At least in the simplest model, where you have dust or perfect fluid or something, there are no critical solutions. This effect. That's the key point, that once the matter density becomes a few hundred times Planck density, then the repulsive force just wins. And so.
Yeah, it can't be arranged that it balances.
That's right. With standard matter, with energy conditions, we can't have it. Now, what about and what about the inflationary scenario? So the detailed calculations here were done for the m squared, phi squared potentials, but I mean numerical calculations, not the theory. The theory is valid for general potentials. So in m squared, phi squared potentials, what happens is the following. Here is again volume, and here the universe is expanding exponentially up here. If I go back in time, then I reach a point at which the inflaton is increasing up here. Because during inflation, the inflaton goes down the potential. If you go up in the backward in time, then the inflaton is rising up the potential. But actually, there is a turnaround point that would occur if you went sufficiently far. Inflation starts somewhere here. Before that, there's a turnaround point. Classical relativity is valid up here. You come back, and then if I use classical relativity, I would get a big bang. But instead here, you get a big bounce, and you come on the other side. So on all these models, the statement is that singularity is resolved.
Could also have another branch that goes up rather than down, couldn't you?
Here? In classical relativity?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think it always comes down, I'm pretty sure, with m squared phi squared potential.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it always comes down. So, now what I said is that the Big Bang singularity is resolved. But then there's a standard thing that you might hear about from inflationary people, from many people, cosmologists. That, well, but it doesn't matter really, because whatever happened before inflation is not relevant for observations. Because everything that happened is going to be completely washed away because of observations. So this is a standard thing that you hear, but that's not quite right. Pre-inflationary dynamics matters. Why? Well, the standard argument is the following. Here I'm plotting time scales, and here I'm plotting length scales. Okay. So basically, this is one upon the Hubble constant, or what is called the Hubble radius, a Hubble parameter, or called the Hubble radius. During inflation, it is approximately constant. And before the onset of inflation, the Hubble parameter becomes infinite at the Big Bang. So Hubble radius goes to zero at the Big Bang. So what we are now doing is the following. The blue, you have got various modes in the perturbations that we actually observe. And what happens is that the wavelength of these modes grows just as a scale factor. So it's exponential in time, so that grows. But here, during inflation, this is constant. Therefore, these modes start exiting the Hubble radius. And that is when all the interesting dynamics happens. But inflation assumes that before these modes exit the Hubble radius, the onset, say, these modes were all in their ground state. And the argument goes as follows. You look at the equation that these modes satisfy, and you see quickly that equation, if these wavelengths are shorter than the Hubble radius up here, then in fact, if you go back in time, then they always remain shorter than the Hubble radius. That means that these modes are never going to experience curvature. And because they don't experience curvature, the idea is that they would not be excited. And therefore, it really doesn't matter here what happened up here. That is a general argument that is given. The argument is not quite right for two reasons. First is not such a profound reason, but I should state it. It is that what matters is not the Hubble radius, but the curvature radius. During inflation, the two are the same, but the computation in the equation of motion of these modes is always between the curvature radius and the wavelength up here. And what happens is the following. The more important point is that the pre-inflationary dynamics of quantum gravity may not look like general relativity at all. It may look completely different. So here, I'm talking about, so what we really want is a curvature radius, so let's just look at the curvature radius. And the curvature radius doesn't go to zero at all. In fact, curvature radius has some finite value here, an universal finite value at the bounds. And therefore, you can have modes like these two modes, which were always inside the curvature radius, and for which this argument is right. If they were not excited here, they would never be excited because these modes don't see curvature. But there can be more, like this one or the next one, which actually will see the curvature radius during this in this Planck epoch, and therefore they would get excited, and therefore when they arrive here, they would not be in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, they would not be in the vacuum state. Now the next thing that people say is that, well, okay, there are a few excitations, but in the exponential expansion, those excitations will get all washed away. But that's not true either, because of stimulated emission. And this was done in great detail by people like Parker, Aguillo, and so on. that because of this exponential expansion, in fact, if we had these modes, then more modes are created, and therefore the energy density in these modes per unit volume, I mean energy density, will actually remain constant during inflation. Therefore, pre-inflationary dynamics matters because some of the modes that we observe might have encountered curvature in the Planck regime, and they might have been excited, and therefore the state at the onset of inflation for perturbations then would not be the Bunch-Davis vacuum, and therefore the power spectrum would be different. The ratio of the tensor to tensor to scalar ratio would be different. The NS and NT, the spectral indices would be different, and so on. So that is what therefore we have to really understand is pre-inflationary dynamics. It could be so different that in fact power spectrum is so different that it is completely ruled out by observations. That could happen, or it may be it may happen that that it is not ruled out, but for future observations, there are some new predictions. And that is what we want to look at. Please.
So would this other, whatever state that they're in, be related to the Bunch-Davis vacuum? Like, is it one of the alpha vacua?
No, it's not one of the alpha vacua. Alpha vacua are not regular.
Right.
So they don't have the Hadamard behavior. So these states will all have Hadamard behavior. They will be related by Bogle-Lippert transformation to the Bunch-Davis vacuum at the onset of inflation. Okay, so this is concludes what I wanted to tell about background geometry. So background geometry, there are two issues. This concludes the first part of it. Namely, there is actually resolution of Big Bang and pre-inflationary dynamics matters. Now, the second part that I just mentioned was the following. In fact, is it that will inflation occur generically in a given theory, or would it be something that will require fine-tuning? So I'm giving you a preview here. There is another transparency that I can use to explain to you in great detail, those who are interested in this. Particular perimeter, I think this is a hot topic because there is a controversy about this topic coming from work of Neil and Gary Gibbons versus Linde and Kaufman and Mukhana. But let me just tell you what the story is in loop quantum cosmology here. So what we want to understand is the following. Will we encounter inflation generically or will we not? And now this requires, of course, a precise formulation of the question. So what we have is the quantum geometry psi naught. But I told you that, in fact, these effective equations work very well. So let me first start with the effective equations. Effective equations are equations just like classical equations, but there are h-bars in it. There's no wave function there. And then we'll come back to what the equation satisfied by the wave function is. So let us begin with the effective theory and consider a generic data at the bounds. So in the effective theory, we look at generic initial data at the bounds. And let us see what. And we want to ask the question, will the solution enter slow roll at the curvature scale, which is the inflationary onset of inflation, about 10 to the minus 11 Planck density. And there are 11 orders of magnitude from the bounds to this thing. Now, in loop quantum cosmology, the answer is yes in the following sense. At the bounds, so here are what I'm plotting is the scalar field and phi dot. So it's like a phase diagram, if you like. And I am squared phi squared potential. So these are constant energy density contours, if you like. So here I got half Planck density. And here I got 10 to the minus 11 Planck density, or 7 times 10 to the minus 12 Planck density. This is the onset of inflation up here. Now what happens is that because of loop quantum cosmology effects, the total energy density has a maximum. And therefore, phi at the bounds is actually also has a maximum. The absolute value has to be less than about a million. Okay. It's not infinite, it's about less than about a million. But if phi bounds is bigger than 0.93, then the initial data evolves to a solution that encounters slow roll compatible. This was done with the 7-year WMAP data. 7-year WMAP data sometime in the future. In this sense, almost every initial data at the bounds evolves to a solution that encounters the desired slow roll sometime in the future. So what we have is the following. Any point in this diagram is the initial data. At the bounds, I can give for the effective equation this point, and then I'll get a dynamical trajectory. This point and dynamical trajectory. And what happens is that almost all of these dynamical trajectories, which are in blue, they all evolve to this tiny region at the onset of inflation. These evolve into this tiny region in the onset of inflation. And this tiny part up here, which is phi bounds 5 bounds is bigger than 0.93, this, or minus 0.93, 5 bounds absolute is this. So this tiny region fills out this big region up here. There's a conservation, it's a phase, it's a Liouville flow, so Liouville volume is actually conserved, but the statement is that it is true that these points all evolve to this little region up here and this little region up here, and this is precisely the WMAP points within the experimental, within the observational errors. And this has been done in great detail in this particular paper, and there are further results by Corici and Karimi, and by Barrow and Lisford. So, for effective dynamics, we see that the trajectories actually do go up here. So now what we want to ask is that for the background quantum geometry, we can now choose a coherent state psi naught, which is sharply peaked at the effective trajectory. Just as what we did before, here, we can choose up here a trajectory which is sharply peaked and evolve in time. So that's what we do for the inflationary case also. We can take a trajectory starting from here and take the psi naught which is sharply peaked and evolve, and it remains peaked, and it ends up being peaked at about a point in this little blue dot region, which is the region which is selected by the observations. Observation says that at the onset of inflation, phi dot should be in this little region, and they do arrive there in that little region. So it remains sharply peaked on the effective trajectory, and hence the desired rollover is automatically occurs in quantum geometry. So the choice of the background psi naught is therefore dictated actually just by giving what the value of phi is at the bounds, because the total energy density is constant, therefore I got a contour like that. So if you give me a point up here and I know what the value of phi is, then I know what the value of phi dot is immediately up here. And therefore, the value of the inflaton at the bounds is often called as a parameter, which is going to tell me what the state is. And this is a free parameter in loop quantum cosmology. This is a new thing that happens in loop quantum cosmology that we have to keep track of.
So just to see if I understand that, so you're saying I should think of this as effectively there's an effective velocity damping term that comes up from the quantum geometry terms?
Yeah, that's one way to say it, exactly. There's in a certain regime, this I can tell you much more detail. There are three phases, and I'll tell you what happens in each phase and so on. But that's right. So now I finished about the background geometry. Now I want to talk about perturbations propagating on this background geometry. See, when we were at this stage, I don't know, a few years ago, right? I mean, we sort of, first it was difficult to believe that in fact singularity was resolved for generic data. Then we found that more and more models and singularity is resolved. And then I said, oh, okay, now let's take the next problem. And the next problem is doing perturbations. And so the first reaction was, come on, it's hopeless. I mean, quantum field theory in curved space times is already so difficult. And now we're talking about quantum field theory on quantum geometries. You know, this is a huge extension. But it turned out that it was possible for simplification that for me was unforeseen. In retrospect, of course, something like this should have happened, but at that time it was unforeseen. So the strategy is the following. We assume that you've got perturbations psi, and assume that they can be regarded as test fields. So their back reaction on the geometry psi naught can be actually ignored. So they propagate test fields which propagate on the quantum geometry psi naught. And now you find the solution, psi naught, semi-direct product of psi perturbation. And finally check that, this is the important part, we want to finally check self-consistency. So you get a solution of this equation, and then you want to check that, in fact, indeed, the energy density in the perturbation is completely negligible to the energy density in the background at all times, from the Planck regime, from the bounds, to the onset of inflation, or these 11 orders of magnitude. Now, this was the unforeseen simplification for me. It is that it turns out that the dynamics of these quantum fields, of these perturbations, this psi depends on. This is the quantum state of the fields, three fields up here, namely the two tensor modes and a scalar mode. So dynamics of perturbations of these fields on quantum geometry psi naught is mathematically equivalent to that of the dynamics of this quantum fields on a smooth space-time. In other words, a space-time equipped with a standard Einstein-type metric. But it's not a classical solution. It's a Drest effective C number metric G bar. It's called Drest because it has H bar corrections into it. It's effective because good approximation, it is approximated very well by the effective dynamics that I talked about, but there is further dressing that is required, as we'll see in a minute. And what is this metric? Well, this metric is conformally flat. It's a Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker metric. Therefore, it is given by a scale factor and a conformal time. And what we do is the following. What you have to do is the following. You see, give me the state psi naught. Then the psi naught itself is evolving via some Hamiltonian H naught. And I got a scale factor of the volume, which is an operator on this wave function psi naught up here. So what I have to do is to take some complicated looking combination of, maybe I should be here first, some complicated looking combinations up here and define an effective dressed scale factor. And similarly, a complicated combination to relate the relational time variable with the conformal time variable up here. And I can do that. There's a statement. I mean, I can just say that, well, calculate these quantities in quantum theory using psi naught and define a bar and eta bar by these equations. I get this metric. And now the not completely non-trivial thing is that these fields propagating on this geometry is isomorphic, not approximated, right? Isomorphic is one-to-one correspondence with the fields propagating on the quantum geometry psi naught, provided you can regard little psi as a test field on this thing. In other words, so long as you assume that under the evolution, psi naught doesn't change significantly because we've got a perturbation, little psi up here. Now, at first it looks very strange, but it's not so strange because, you know, if I had this, again, my water up here, and I have some light falling on that water, really what is happening, as Feynman worked out, I think, in volume 2 of his lectures, what is happening is, of course, there are all these molecules, and each photon is actually, you know, interacting with these water molecules all along. But we know that so long as we can ignore the back reaction, so long as the laser beam doesn't evaporate water, you know, it's, so long as that happens, the statement that effect is completely taken into account by just two parameters, for example, the refractive index and the bifringence. If I give you that, then you can work out what is happening. And that is what is happening up here. We get these two parameters, and the statement is that this is what is, the perturbation doesn't see the details of the quantum state psi. It only sees some moments of this quantum state psi. I could never have guessed these moments. They came out of detailed calculation. So therefore, the mathematical machinery of kind of so-called adiabatic states, ultraviolet regularity, regularization, and renormalization can be lifted to the quantum field theory on quantum cosmological space-times, quantum fields propagating on this, starting with quantum fields on curved space-time. And therefore, we have got a complete control on dynamics. All right. Now, what about the initial conditions of perturbations? So basically, I think what we do is the following. Well, as far as the perturbation is concerned, we demand that there should be symmetry. Since the background state, and hence G bar AB, is homogeneous and isotropic, so we demand that psi should also be invariant under spatial translations and rotations. We demand that there should be regularity, so it should be regular of fourth adiabatic order. You could demand Hadamard regularity, which will be much stronger than this. Maybe we should do that, but this is what is sufficient in order to renormalize the stress energy tensor because it is dimension 4 operator. And we assume that at the bounds, only at the bounds, the test field approximation holds. In other words, the energy density, energy density little psi is negligible compared to that in the background psi naught initially. That is to say at the bounds. So that's what we are assuming up here. And then we go that these are the only assumptions. You see, these are weaker than something like the Budge-Davies vacuum. Because Budge-Davies vacuum is like the Poincaré invariant vacuum. It's like the De Sitter invariant vacuum. You're asking many more symmetries. As we saw, the dynamics near the bounds is nothing like De Sitter dynamics. Right? It's very very, 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 very complicated dynamics up here. So we cannot ask for Budge-Davies vacuum. That is no meaning there. So we ask just these questions up here. This restricts the freedom, but still leaves a lot of freedom. But the statement what we have done so far is really look for states of perturbations, little psi, with these initial conditions, evolve and see what happens. It could have happened that we start some states with made some choices which are well defined, well motivated, which I can tell you during discussion period. But we just want to evolve and see what happens. And then the statement is that the question is whether in fact we'll get compatibility with observations. Are there deviations from the predictions of the standard inflation and so on? So here are the results. The first question we want to ask is the following. Is this self-consistent? Is it true that the energy density in the perturbation is actually always negligible compared to the energy density in the background. So here are the Planck seconds, starting from the bounce, and the onset of inflation is a little bit further here, about a million Planck seconds up here. And what we see is that, of course, after about 100,000 Planck seconds, the energy density in the perturbation is completely negligible. By now, actually, the classical general relativity has already become a good approximation, and with the energy density is also negligible in the perturbation compared to the background. But before that, it's not negligible, as you might expect. In the Planck regime, the statement is that, it is still negligible, but it's not as negligible. In the Planck regime, it can be up to 5%. So the statement is that up to these errors of about 5%, which at that time were WMAP kind of errors, the statement is that, in fact, we do have a self-consistent solution. Now that we have got better data, people are also redoing these calculations with much more physical input in them in order to see if, in fact, one can improve accuracy. And there are also numerical issues, which are very interesting, that came up here, which we did not bother too much. What I'm plotting here is the upper bound of the energy density in the perturbation to energy density in the background. So it's not that we have 5%, it is less than 5%. So the question is, can we get much better estimates of this? And people are now doing that numerically. What about the power spectrum? So we calculate the power spectrum. And again, here, for simplicity and because of time, I'm just plotting the ratio. So here is the loop quantum cosmology predictions up here. And here would be the standard Bayes-Davis predictions up here. So in other words, if in fact loop quantum cosmology had agreed with Bayes-Davis, I should just get this to be 1. And we see that, in fact, this is 1 in this regime, but it's not 1 in this regime. What is x-axis? So this is the ratio of the power spectrum. And the x-axis is the co-moving radius k up here. You can think of it as roughly, very roughly, as being the angular scale, right? I mean, we'll come to that in just 1 second. As you increase k, you are going into smaller and smaller angular scales. So so in this case, the data, this simulation was done with some initial data up here, and So now we can convert into the CLs. And what we find is, of course, that for large Ls, large Ks, there's agreement with both the Bayes-Davis vacuum or standard inflation and WMAP data. They all agree very well. But in fact, you can choose states, initial states, satisfying our initial conditions, satisfying our criteria, the 3 criteria I wrote down, such that for L less than 30, in fact, you get a suppression of power spectrum up here in LQC compared to the standard inflationary prediction, which is for the Bayes-Davis vacuum. So where does this L equal to 30 come from? Well, it comes from as follows. Let's go back to this slide where I try to explain the difference between loop quantum cosmology and Bayes-Davis. So over here, we've got a curvature scale that is coming in, that is universal. And now we've got some modes whose wavelength has to be bigger than this curvature scale, and which should be observable today. And the statement is basically that the largest wavelength modes up here, they are the ones with the smallest Ls. And therefore, really, those modes, you have to look at the modes which are observable today, and then see how many of them have exited the curvature radius. How many of them have experienced the curvature during the Planck regime? It is those modes which get affected. And these, contrary to one's first intuition, is actually corresponds to the longest wavelength rather than the smallest wavelength. Please.
So that means that L equals 30 is a particular something particular to M squared phi squared. So if the curvature radius evolved differently in a different potential, it would be L of 20 or something else.
Yeah, it could be something. So right now the detailed calculations are being done with other potentials. At this time, we just wanted to know if there's some interesting thing that happens, but that is an important question, and one should really look at
it. You could actually put it at other Ls, couldn't you, by changing this phi b parameter?
Say it again.
By changing the phi b parameter.
Yes, phi b parameter, exactly. Okay, so if it turns out that I choose phi b to be sufficiently large, then there will be no deviation from the Bayes-Davis vacuum at all. Mm-hmm. It really is a choice of this phi b. So again, with this other potential, there is still a parameter, and we'll still have to choose the value of this parameter. And the question that we are always asking is not, is this a unique prediction, but rather, as in physics we normally do, there is actually a window in the parameter space, and is there some window in which what we observe might actually be realized? Now it could be that this suppression is just purely, as people have sort of felt, it's completely consistent with just cosmic variance, right? With just statistics. So here we're taking the point of view, but well, you know, standard model is working so well, except in this regime. So let's just suppose, I mean, maybe, is it providing us a window into quantum gravity? Let's just assume it does. Then is there a mechanism within quantum gravity which will suppress it? And then the statement is yes, there is a mechanism. So at the moment, it is only a statement of existence of mechanism proof, not that this is the unambiguous prediction of loop quantum cosmology. This is more like, you know, like what people do in particle physics all the time. I mean, in phenomenological particle physics, you have a parameter space and do the predictions of the theory for some parameter space actually agree with observations. Now we can also calculate with the same initial state what I showed up here were the temperature-temperature correlations. We can calculate the temperature-electric polarization correlations. And again, the statement is that LQC shows a small power suppression. And similarly, for the EE correlations, you see that LQC shows a power suppression. The reason why this is interesting is the following. Because supposing the power suppression is real, it's not because of cosmic variance, but it's real. But still, it could be primordial, right? And like what we're saying up here. Or it could be something that happened later in the evolution of the universe. We don't know. People have proposed models that it might happen because of Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. But of course, you know, all those calculations, as the authors themselves point out, are somewhat contrived. They have to make assumptions about the evolution history of the universe of certain kind, and then you'll find that, in fact, there can be power suppression. But if, in fact, this happened because of this later evolution, then it turns out that the TE correlations, so the TT correlations will be suppressed. The TE would not be suppressed. Whereas here, TE are suppressed. So this is a prediction which will distinguish primordial origin from later origin. And this is how science should be. I mean, one is not saying this happened, but one is actually looking at quantum gravity effects which can distinguish, which can be distinguished from effects that happen later on. So this is the reason why I'm saying that loop quantum gravity, loop quantum cosmology has become mature in order to make such predictions, basically. So let me summarize. The early universe provides an ideal setting to test quantum gravity ideas. And the key questions that we had was, can one obtain extension of the successful cosmological scenarios to include the Planck regime? Can the pre-inflationary Planck scale dynamics leave observable imprints? Now, again, I want to emphasize that there is no approach to quantum gravity that has been successful, right? I mean, I'm not saying that loop quantum gravity is finished and we took the finished theory and worked this out. So how could we make a progress? In loop quantum gravity, progress has been made by truncating the theory to the physical problem under consideration and solving it. It's a little like what Dirac did when he solved the hydrogen atom using the Dirac equation. He solved just a huge spherical symmetric potential and solved it, right? So in Dirac's thing, you know, you assume that the problem is spherical symmetric, the electric field is spherical symmetric, so he's putting away the photons altogether. There are no photons, right? Because there are no spherical symmetric photons. And yet, you know, you sort of, it captures, of course, it doesn't capture everything. When you go to lamp shift, that's not good. But, you know, it captures many, many effects. It's a bit like that. So what we're doing is we're saying that, well, focus on the physical problem of interest. And here the physical problem of interest is the early universe. And what is the mathematical setting? It is the Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker background, together with perturbations. So it's infinitesimal perturbations that are allowed up here. We take this setting and we analyze the sector of the theory using loop quantum gravity, and then we obtain these particular predictions. And the prediction is basically that loop quantum gravity in this sense does provide for us a self-consistent extension for this particular sector of general relativity. As far as the background geometry is concerned, there is singularity resolution and precise quantum geometry in the Planck regime. I just wanted to show this code particularly for students, because here is what Einstein had to say about the Big Bang. Because most of the students grew up saying, oh, Big Bang is a truth, and you know, that's how the universe began, and the imprint of God, and et cetera, et cetera. It's none of that, right? Because first of all, what we have seen is a cosmic microwave background. Even if you trust general relativity all the way, cosmic microwave background occurred at 300,000 years ago. You know, it doesn't say anything about whether there was a Big Bang or not. Similarly, at the onset of inflation, inflation is successful, but at the onset of inflation, the energy density is about 10 to the minus 11 times Planck density. Doesn't know anything about what happened early on. So none of these are proofs of Big Bang at all. And here is what Einstein had to say. Einstein said in his Meaning of Relativity book in 1945, one may not assume the validity of field equations at very high density of field. By that he means high curvature and density of matter. And one may not conclude that the beginning of the expansion of the universe should be a singularity in the mathematical sense that everything actually blows up. And in fact, look on cosmology, the statement is that this is actually resolved. What about perturbations? So this was for the background. Well, since they propagate on quantum geometry, then using quantum field theory on cosmological quantum geometry, Transplanckian problems can be handled systematically. And we had a route to handle them, provided the test field approximation holds. And because then the statement is that we had this alternate description of wave functions propagating quantum geometry being completely equivalent to wave functions propagating on an effective dressed matter. And the statement is that there exist natural states, natural solutions, which actually, in which the test field approximation does hold. Now, this is an interesting thing. Namely, one might say, why were we specifying the initial conditions of the bounds? Now, the intuition behind this is not hard, detailed calculations, but there's an intuition behind this, which I would like to explain. And the intuition is basically the following. You take these inflationary models, this like m squared, phi squared potential, and you go back in time. And you can want to say, well, look at the observable universe today at the cosmic microwave background. What was the size at the onset of at the Big Bounce? Now, at the Big Bounce, its size was about 1 to 10 Planck length. That is what it's like. The whole universe that we see today was only about 1 to 10 Planck length, expanded out, and that's what we see today. So what we need is some initial conditions on these balls of 1 to 10 Planck length up here. But on the other hand, in loop quantum gravity, I told you, loop quantum cosmology, I told you that there is this repulsive force. And that repulsive force has exactly this power, right? Namely, once the curvature, any of the curvature scalars starts becoming very, very concentrated, very, very inhomogeneous, this actually dilutes them, this effective force, and makes them homogeneous again. So the idea, and that operates also in about 8 Planck length radius, right? So the idea up here is that, you know, really what happened before doesn't matter. As far as the observable universe is concerned, what happened before the bounce doesn't matter. I really want to know what happened in this little patch which actually expanded out to our universe. And there is a mechanism to make such patches homogeneous. A patch here might be homogeneous, a patch here might be homogeneous, but they may be quite different from each other. And if you had ability to see modes of that longer wavelength, you would see the big differences. But we don't. Our observable universe is really, the wavelength is, if I trace back the wavelength, it is less than 10 Planck length. And in this 10 Planck length, everything is homogeneous. And therefore, the prehistory basically is erased by this repulsive force. That is the intuition why we're focusing on the Big Bounce. This is not, we're not attached to it in the sense that if some refined version tells us that we should start a little bit before, a little bit after, that's what we'll do. But this is the reason why we're doing it. OK, then the statement is that there are natural restrictions on initial conditions at the bounce in this allowed class. And there is agreement with the standard Budge-Davis vacuum-based inflation for L greater than 30 or so. In this sense, loop quantum cosmology provides a natural extension of the inflationary paradigm or 12 orders of magnitude in curvature from the bounce to the onset of inflation. But for low values of L, there can be deviations, and there are some imprints that are possible. This is the area of active research. A lot of work is being done up here. For example, the famous consistency relation, even for a single inflaton, gets modified, and so people are trying to work out signatures, which are for future observations here. Final comments. Well, this issue of initial conditions, I want to stress that we have not solved the issue of initial conditions. We have only restricted the initial conditions to a certain class. We're looking really for a physical principle. And this is where the interchange between theory and observations comes in. Let's suppose for a minute that, in fact, the power suppression is because of the primordial reason, because of our initial states were of a certain kind. Then the statement is that among the class of states that we allow, from regularity, from symmetry principles, there is a much smaller subclass which will actually give you power suppression. So it's really sort of calling us, drawing our attention to see if there is actually a physical principle which selects out this subclass. Is there something? And there are ideas based on generalizing Roger Penrose's wild curvature hypothesis, which might actually lead us to such subclass. And this is an active area of research. So this is a sense in which, on the one hand, loop quantum cosmology is making some predictions for future observations. On the other hand, looking at the observations, we can look at something about theory of initial conditions, some physical principle that we have missed so far. But these initial conditions will tell us that there is such a, the observations will tell us that there is actually such preferred principle which dictates the initial conditions. So these initial investigations have opened a small window in the space of the parameter space where quantum gravity effects could leave observable imprints. And this window is now being analyzed in great detail. And some new and interesting structures have emerged that I can mention in discussions. So I just want to emphasize final caveat that loop quantum cosmology does not take into account any of the particle physics issues. So the analysis simply assumes an inflaton in a suitable potential. This was the detailed calculations here were done pi m squared phi squared, but as I just mentioned in answer to a question, when people are now looking at other several other potentials. Therefore, it cannot imply that loop quantum cosmology cannot imply that inflation must have occurred. It just simply assumes that there was an inflaton with a suitable potential, and then the probability is very high, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, loop quantum cosmology framework can be and is being used to address quantum gravity issues, also in non-inflationary scenarios, like periodic models, the matter-dominated bounces that Robert Brandenburger works with. These are being looked at in great detail using also loop quantum cosmology techniques, the quantum geometry of quantum gravity. Thank you.
Could you go back to the final fits for the power spectrum?
Whatever that here, setting the
stage. So my question is the following. If I compare Vance David's standard scenario with loop quantum cosmology, it's hard to tell from looking at that if it's a better fit.
I agree. So, and also, I'm not trying to say that this is the. Let me elaborate this so quickly. Just looking at it intuitively, I mean, that's probably the same problem. But if you really count one, so basically, what Planck does is between 0 and 30, they actually plot. For each L, the points, there are 30 points up to here as well. After that, they bin the data, therefore there are fewer points up here. So if you just count the points at which they fit, and this thing, then the statement is that yes, it is a better fit. This is what people who do these numerical fits have sort of told us, the numerical one. But, I mean, is this really such a big fit, such a big effect, that in fact we should sort of trust this as being really there? No, I don't say so. I think these are indications. This was for a particular initial state. Maybe the initial state has to be chosen more carefully. Maybe there's a physical principle and we didn't quite hit it. So these are really opening in windows into looking at the interplay between observations and fundamental theory, not the final predictions of the theory. These are the directions in which we are looking at.
Is there also an explanation why, I mean, if you look at the rest of the curve, seems that the two observations agree much better.
Right.
They start to deviate in this.
Yeah. So the point is that these modes, these are the L's, they are larger L's. So these are the higher values of K's or smaller values of wavelength. If you have cosmologists, you think more in terms of K's, and if you have relativists, you think in terms of wavelengths. Okay. So these are higher values of K's up here. And these modes never encounter curvature in the Planck regime. So again, going back. So those higher modes that we looked at, higher L's, they correspond to smaller wavelength, right? Smaller K is a smaller wavelength, angles, high, Higher L's is more like wavelength because of angular separation. So those modes are like these modes. So they never encounter curvature even in the Planck regime. The modes for which there is deviation are modes like here. I should have drawn more. The mode of modes up here. These modes see the deviation. So there are very few modes which actually see the curvature in the Planck regime. This is the curvature radius. So what are the modes which in the Planck regime, when they propagate, they actually exit the curvature radius and therefore see the curvature, the spatial curvature, so that they can be excited.
Actually, my question was a different one, sorry, I wasn't very clear. If you look at the data itself, why is the data in this regime, it seems that the Planck W map, they seem to disagree more.
I think the problem is that you're not showing the error bar, so the error bars get much bigger there because of the cosmic variance. So,
or here, even. Yeah, on the left hand side.
Yeah.
On the left hand side.
Right.
So, yeah.
So that's why people don't worry about it too much because the error bars are getting large there.
Is your question on this end of the spectrum or on this end of the spectrum?
The left end.
The left.
Left end. Yeah, so here there are error bars, and the statement is that the error bars are quite large here. Maybe we should show the error bars and see.
Cosmic variance is a theory error bar, right?
We could discuss it. It's somewhere between theory and observation because they have one sky.
It's not instrumental.
It's not.
Well,
it's not in the instrument.
I think, in the sense that the universe is our instrument, so. If you had multiple universes,
it's not the fault of the experimenters.
No, we have one sample.
But the theorists have multiverses, so if this experiment can only explore other universes, then.
yeah, so it could be that, you know, it's just.
Can you actually explore the other?
I'm just kidding.
The Planck mass is an input in this theory.
Yeah, Planck mass.
Do you dream of a theory where it is predicted or captured?
Not in this theory. Everything is here. It is input in this theory. The Planck. Yeah, Planck constant and the gravitational constant at low energy.
You have a simple explanation why you always get suppression in power spectrum, why you don't get amplification?
No, it's good question, right? So the question is, no. So the statement is that you could choose other states for which there could be also amplification. So this is the question that I was saying, that, well, is there a principle now? So this now what one has done is just analysis now, right? I mean, this has happened, the fact, checklist of facts. And now what we would like to do is to understand, is there a principle? Maybe there isn't. Maybe this is all cosmic values. I don't know. But the way that we always do research is always be optimistic and see what happens. Okay.
So there's another observational thing that might or might not be there that people talk about sometimes, which is at low L is kind of anisotropy. Did you look at that?
I have not, but Ivan Aguirre has, and he has similar explanation coming from loop quantum cosmology that there should be an anisotropy of that kind, particular kind, but it's really is not work that is even written up yet, so he's still doing it.
But you might have something.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very careful worker, so he's a.
I mean, Joel Mangangio and I looked at which one, using some statistical analysis, which in the end I wasn't completely happy with, but never mind. Which one would we take more seriously between the two? And for us, it was the anisotropy more seriously than
the solid
power.
No, yeah. So Ivan is looking at it in detail. He actually.
I'm curious about your version of Roger's law of curvature hypothesis. Can you state it quantum mechanically?
Yeah. Okay. So. Give me 30 seconds to explain to everybody else what Roger's idea was. So, I mean, Roger has had this idea for 30 years or so, which is basically the fact that if I look at the Big Bang singularity of general relativity, if I look at the early universe, that's what he means, right? Then I find that the early universe is extraordinarily homogeneous and isotropic, except for these tiny inhomogeneities that we talked about. Now, if you have spatial slices which are homogeneous and isotropic, then you can go and see what does it tell us about the curvature. And the statement is that it's also true that in these Friedman models, the wild curvature is zero. Wild curvature is identically zero. And there's a correlation between the two, but let me not go into too much into that. It just, you know, I know you decompose things, the electric and magnetic parts, the wild tensor, and so on. But there's a correlation between the two. So Weyl's, Roger's idea was that if I look at the Weyl curvature is zero at the Big Bang singularity. And what is diverging is the Ricci curvature. Whereas in the future, in the black hole singularities, is the Weyl curvature which diverges, and because of the vacuum solution, there is no Ricci curvature at all. So he felt that, well, there's something obvious here in our universe, and therefore the initial conditions should actually talk about this Weyl curvature being zero. The initial singularity was Weyl curvature equal to zero. Now, when you go to quantum theory, however, to me at least, it's not completely meaningful. It cannot take it over because I don't expect there to be singularity at all. Right? And then I had many, many discussions with Roger. I think he would agree that it should be replaced by some principle which captures its essence. So what we're trying to do up here is the following. We're saying that instead of the Big Bang, you look at the bounds, because that is where the maximum curvature occurs up here. And what we would like to say is that the state should be such, state is psi naught, total psi if you like, or psi naught tensor product with perturbations. The total state should be such that the expectation value of the Weyl tensor should be zero in that state. And furthermore, the fluctuations, so now if I take the Weyl tensor cannot be zero, it's an operator, and there is no state which would kill them. So what you can do is to decompose it into electric and magnetic parts, and morally, that canonically conjugate to each other. Morally, I say, because two derivatives. Right. So that canonically conjugate to each other. So what you try can do, and furthermore, they are the same dimensions physically. That's important. Because therefore, what I can do is I can look for a state for which the product of the uncertainties in the electric and magnetic part is minimum. And it is shared equally between them. So it's not a squeeze state. I can look for a state like that. If in the Minkowski-Fox space I looked at that state like that, for which the expectation value of the Weyl curvature is zero perturbating Minkowski space, and the uncertainties are spread equally, I do get the vacuum state. The geometry were completely flat. So the question is really here the idea would be that in these dynamical situations, that's what one would like to say. Somehow the initial singularity, the initial big state is spatial because early on, Weyl curvature was as zero as it could be, except that Heisenberg forbids us from putting it equal to zero.
Okay, but here's what I'm puzzled about. The way that Roger stated it, as you put it, it's time asymmetric because you impose it at the Big Bang initial singularity, not final singularity. But you have a bounce. So if it holds just after the bounce, doesn't it hold just before the bounce? And doesn't that break the time irreversibility?
That's why it's not completely the same as what Roger is saying up here. But on the other hand, we do have black hole singularity, right? In which there is a Weyl curvature. So this is modification of Roger's original idea. Not everything actually goes into, I don't have it, as you say, there's no built-in time asymmetry here. We're just saying that there is actually a initial state and we just evolve. And the only reason we evolve forward rather than backward is because that's what the observable universe is completely dictated by what happened at the door of 10 Planck length, and that 10 Planck length, all the previous memory is gone. So we just look at this, and then the question is, well, we would like to know what the state is of the gravitational field in this ball of 10 Planck length, and then the state may be, and then once we move on to the I agree with you, that is not the same otherwise.
Now, can you evolve? You have two kinds of regions, perhaps. You have your very homogeneous regions and your inhomogeneous regions, the rest of it. Can you evolve both of them backwards through the bounce and tell us how they're different from each other?
You embrace inhomogeneous?
No, when you say the universe inflated from a small region which was homogeneous, but there might have been other regions which were inhomogeneous.
Right.
But since you have a bounce, you can go back to the bounce for both kinds of regions.
So you can look at the bounce. And the statement would be that there will be homogeneous here, there will be homogeneous here. It's like approximating an inhomogeneous situation with little, what people do in numerical relativity or some numerical calculations, by boxes which are homogeneous. But the mean density, mean every field here is different from mean density, mean field here, etc.
So do you get a picture a little bit like Lindsay's picture, in which those regions where the states were sufficiently homogeneous do bounce to an inflation, and the regions which are not sufficiently homogeneous bounce to something which is not inflation?
No, we only looked at the things which are homogeneous. We only looked at these 10 balls which are homogeneous. And they bounce. that's the statement. So I think what we're trying to do is to say that, well, once in a while there will be some region which is inhomogeneous, and then what happens? And we're not done that calculation.
Any more questions? Okay. Follow up
to Lee's question.
Okay. So I didn't understand exactly the status of this mild curvature statement. So if one, in Roger's view, there was actually a beginning, or at least the beginning of space-time, as we know it, and so it would make sense from a certain point of view to impose boundary conditions there. For you, the beginning would be at some infinitely large universe back in the infinite past, which is, seems that's where would, depending where one would impose boundary conditions. So if you have the small vial curvature at the bounds, it seems like that ought to be arising dynamically, not as some
basic principle. So, I mean, this is why it is not, I think, what, I don't know if it comes back, if it comes back, I'll just. So, this is the part that I'm not saying here. This is the ball, etc. So the statement up here is that there is something in loop quantum gravity that we would like to explore more. And I don't know how to do it from completely fundamental principles, in part because we don't have a fundamental loop quantum gravity theory. So this is this wild gravity hypothesis is a way of getting handle on this. Namely, that any time any of these curvature scalars, like for example, BIT models, you look at the shear potentials, which are potentials for the wild tensor. They grow, they become infinite in the big maximum value. So, but in loop quantum cosmology, they all dilute. They all dilute, so they don't become infinite at all. They remain finite. So this what is happening is that any time this curvature scalar is becoming large, it is being diluted. And what I'm trying to say is that well. They may be a very large curvature being built up and then it is diluted. And that is what is occurring at this surface up here. So we're trying to capture what is happening at this surface. That's why it is different from Roger's idea in several different ways. I mean, one was universal, the other was. So this is a way to, in other words, in a way, what they not even mention wild curvature hypothesis. But the idea is basically that this dilution is one way to formulate the conjecture about what is happening in loop quantum gravity, and they try to prove it or disprove it, would be to say that, in fact, what is happening is that you get a state in which this quantum version of wild curvature hypothesis is actually in the sense.
It's arising dynamically.
It is dynamically, exactly. But dynamically, not everywhere, but in this.
So could you comment on this whole separation between the background and the perturbations and why the perturbations persist to be small. Is this because of the symmetries that you have in the system, or is it something that's a feature of the...
I don't have a global understanding of when it will happen and why, you know, I don't have a global understanding of that. But, in other words, we have to do the numerical calculation, otherwise I would not have known a priori, yeah, it's always going to be small, I tell you that. But this is always a surprising thing, and again we find, right? I mean, that somehow the universe seems to be much simpler than we thought, right? Because all of us thinking about quantum gravity, many other people, and even now, some people even now, they say, but how can it be that it's so homogeneous and so on? There's the Planck scale, there should be all kinds of things that are happening, right? And the statement here seems to be that there are self-consistent solutions, so this is allowed. One is not saying this is a generic situation by any means, but that such states exist is a surprise, and one would like to understand it. But as you say, how generic is this, and will it happen in many cases? But I don't have any